Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, you're very welcome along to this week's edition of The Group Chat. I am news correspondent Richard Chambers. I am joined beside me by political correspondent Gavin Riley.
Richard, how are you?
And fellow news correspondent Zara King.
Hello, how are you?
Good, how are you keeping, guys?
Yeah, good, actually. Not too bad, yeah.
We are joined in the studio this week by Alina Kalmykova from Ukraine. There's been a lot of talk about Ukrainian refugees over the last while. A lot of talk about Ukrainians, but not a lot of talk with Ukrainians, I think, in the media. Is that something you've noticed yourself, do you think?
I think yes, sometimes happens. And it happened to me. I've been interviewed already, so I'm glad to be here today in this studio.
We're so delighted you came in, aren't we? We're thrilled. Definitely. Like, thank you so much for making the journey out.
Thank you for inviting.
Yeah, no, definitely. And this isn't your first interview thing. You've done a couple before.
I've done a couple before, yeah. And all of them were published also over the media. But this one is first on the TV, I think.
Well, thank you for that.
Thank you so much. Yeah. And we're honored to have you for your first TV slot.
First TV appearance.
Yeah. Alina, take us back to what happened in your life from February 24th. What happened in your life? How did it change from that date?
Insane, because previously I lived a totally good life. I was absolutely satisfied and I was traveling a lot. And actually I came back to Ukraine after traveling to Portugal, then to Italy. And I found out there is something being happened in country, which I wasn't thinking about and I wasn't ready. Then I had to flee in from war, and I was fleeing from war actually the 1st of March. Then escaped to Budapest, stayed there about 2 weeks, and then moved to Ireland. And actually, it was incredible because I haven't thought about it. I could never imagine I would be traveling to Ireland because it was the only one country opened to Ukrainians who are English speaking. Mm. So I understood there was the only one. Good country because I had already English experience in English, working with English, because I was engaged in the different international projects. So I thought that would be nice. And I have never been there before. And most of the people, they told me it would be a very nice country. You would like it.
Nice. So, can you tell us about that process from when you left your home in Kyiv, isn't it?
Kyiv, yeah.
When you left there, how did you find that process of getting across Europe? Because that's been quite difficult for a lot of people. What was it like for you?
First by foot, then paying crazy amount of money for taxi with crossing the border because it wasn't impossible to cross by foot. It was huge lines of people staying there and waiting to be invited to other countries. Then Hungary wasn't that special. They were trying to help and locals were engaged, but no one could understand what was happened. So for me, it was totally insane. I would say honestly, I was almost sleeping 2 weeks staying there. But I found a job. Then I found out it was impossible to stay for a long time because I have to learn local language, which is not that simple.
Hungarian is a difficult language.
Yeah.
It's a bit of it's a quirky one.
It's difficult. Yeah, it's difficult. So that's why it happened. Ireland happened to me.
So after 2 weeks then in Hungary, you decide that Ireland is where you want to come, and you've already heard that Ireland is open to people from your country,
yeah,
especially with the language.
Yeah.
How did you find it getting here? And then where did you end up sleeping for the first while that you were here?
Oh, I ended up sleeping in a gym. I was accommodated in a gym because it was St. Patrick's Day and we're lack of hotels accommodation. Mm. And then later, one of my friends, because I was fleeing from war with my neighbor, who I saw first time in my life, she was a sister of my designers at my work, and she asked to pick up her sister too, so we decided to flee together because it would be much more easier for two girls traveling together.
You mentioned the gym for the first couple of nights, so what was that like? Was that sort of like camp beds and it's sort of on a gym floor? What was
not Ukrainians only were sleeping there, also some people from Nigeria and Morocco, maybe, I don't know, different countries. And all the locals were very friendly towards us. They were trying to help. One of those ladies even brought me pajama because I was asking for, I had nothing to yeah. choose. Yeah. And she brought her own pajama, a new one from Primark.
That was lovely.
That was really lovely. Yeah. So all of them were acting very friendly. They were very supportive, but this is not conditions of staying. People really have to stay in. It's abnormal, I think.
But that's what a lot of people now are. The situation now is it's become worse over the last number of weeks. So that's actually become quite normal for a lot of people, is to be in that sort of camp beds on a gym floor sort of situation at this point.
I think they have no other choice because most of them, they don't speak any languages except very small English, very poor English. So that's why they choose Ireland. And also there was a massive PR campaign about Ireland. Massive. That's why. That is the issue.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that? Because sometimes we in Ireland don't realise how much communications there's been outside of the country to make people aware that Ireland is open and available to people from your country. So how early did you find out, or how early do people from Ukraine find out that Ireland is willing to take them and that there aren't any visa requirements?
Mostly on the Facebook, because there are so many Facebook groups for Ukrainians traveling somewhere and fleeing from war, and also over the internet, because Irish government, they put so many messages over the internet also, and on the official sites also, they are already hosting Ukrainians and they are welcoming Ukrainians.
But is there any clarity in those messages about the type of accommodation that people can expect? Is there any sort of indication of what is a reasonable expectation when you come to Ireland, or is it just a case of come to Ireland and worry about that later?
I got it. First, it was reasonable expectations because they told they would provide some hotels accommodation, but not of them were provided. And also individuals like me, they were not provided because I was the only one person. I was alone fleeing from war because my family stays in Ukraine still.
And who's at home?
My mom and my grandma, because it's impossible to move for them somewhere.
And how are they?
So, because Kyiv feels like absolutely not that empty, but people living in the dark.
Yeah.
That's something I suppose people might have seen that over the headlines for the last while, that power has become scarcer in Kyiv and other cities like that because of attacks on infrastructure. I mean, for a while it seemed like Kyiv was escaping. You know, it had a quiet number of months, if you could even put it like that. But over the last couple of weeks, it's definitely gotten, you know, more and more into the fire.
I know some friends of mine who were traveling to Ireland, and they were about settling here because of kids and because of tough conditions of living in Ukraine also. And they even had some money, and they were trying to find an accommodation for crazy amount of money. For example, one room costs 1,300 euros in Clondalkin, just one room.
So, no, the prices are incredible. Do you get a chance to talk to your mom and your grandmother often? Do you
often, often. Now they have some issues with internet connections. But is that a constant
worry for you, even as you try to establish a life here, that you are constantly worrying about those you've left?
I'm constantly worrying about them. Yeah. Because no one knows what can happen in a few seconds.
Was there ever any time for the few months where things seemed to be quiet, relatively quiet in Kyiv, where the battle seemed to leave the capital and until a few weeks ago when it came back? Was there ever a time where you sort of felt tempted, or that you might have felt it was ever safe or comfortable to go back and to be with your mother and your grandmother?
I didn't even visit Kyiv. It's been almost 8 months, 7.5 as I'm staying here. And I never visited Ukraine.
Because sometimes people from Ireland, they would have perceived, if they've been following it on the news, but they would have seen a few months go by without there being any mention of any attacks on the capital. So many people might think, well, if it was safe, for example, for the Irish embassy to reopen and for the Irish staff there to go back and to live on the ground and to work there, they would wonder whether it was safe for people like you to go back to home effectively.
Well, I have some friends who were thinking about traveling back home, and some of them even traveled and they are trying to settle again. And now what I see, they're messaging me like, we are traveling to Portugal, we are traveling to Poland, we are going to United States, we're going to Canada, because it's not safe. It's not safe, and the conditions of living are tough.
I think that's something which I think it's important to sort of stress, is that this is anything about your old life becomes completely flipped upside down. And I think that's we have that conversation about, well, when will people think about going home? But like, their country and their homes will never be the same again. Is that something that you think about as well?
I think that is an issue also, because they will travel to their native cities, and then they will find out there is no more Ukraine. Or Ukraine is totally different. It's a different country. And people are different because of mindset. Mindset has changed.
Could you tell us a little bit more about your own life before you left and before the war started? I mean, you're living in Kyiv. You told us a little bit about that you have your mother and your grandmother there. But what is life like? Because, I mean, people who might not follow the news that closely will hear of Ukraine. They'll hear of Kyiv, but they won't know much about it. They won't know much about what the city is like. Like, I think from people you do hear about Kyiv and they talk about such a vibrant city and a really buzzing sort of culture. I mean, what is Kyiv like? What was your life like before you came here?
My life was amazing. I was working as a public relations director for an investment company and for several different projects. I was totally engaged into social life. I was socializing all the time. I was traveling all the time somewhere. And for me, it was like, I wouldn't say super high end, but it was good, really good. So I had interesting circles for communications, like diplomacy circles. Actually, I have the same circles here also. That's why I like Ireland also. But we had good conditions of living because we have now the type of accommodational crisis. We can buy something for us. Yeah, prices sometimes are different. They are not that huge as here. But we can pay for accommodation. We can pay. Here it would be told as a mortgage.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
At what point in the last 8 months has it become clear to you that that sort of life and that sort of lifestyle is unlikely to ever come back? Because I guess maybe for the first couple of weeks, you wonder how long war might be going on for. You don't know how long you might have to leave the country for. You don't know what state the country will be in when you decide to go back. I'm guessing at some point in the last 8 months, you've realized that if you ever did go back, things would never be like they were.
I don't know. Where am I in the nearest 2 weeks? Because we have, because even here, yes, I have someone who is able to host me and that's it. And but housing problem is a huge problem. I think the first one in Ireland. And maybe I will travel to another country. Maybe many people staying here right now also will travel to another country. Who knows? And most likely I'm unable to return home at least nearest 2 years. And no one knows what is going to happen after. Because there is a huge risk of huge war.
And when you look at the situation now and what Ireland is offering people now, and I suppose the fact that maybe some people might say that there was very little notice about this running out, that it was kind of flagged a week in advance, does that upset you to see that, like, you know, this could have been predicted, that this shortage was coming for such a long time? And that, how do you feel the Irish government has handled the communications around all of that?
They don't tell anything. They don't provide any information about it. And even yet they haven't provided it. I think they should mention, because there is huge accommodational crisis. We are, yes, we are welcoming you. We will provide you some work permissions and permissions to stay and live. And that is absolutely fair. And we really do appreciate that. And we do really appreciate all that provided help. But you have to say that there is a lack of accommodation. There is shortage of building. We don't provide a housing for local people. Be honest.
Have you seen things change since you arrived here? You arrived here on St. Patrick's Day back in March. Do you think that the attitude and the response of Irish people towards Ukraine and to people who have arrived here from Ukraine, have you noticed that change in any way?
Well, people were very responsive, but I think over the few months, something has changed. And I think that's why Irish government provided that they doubled the fees.
The payment for hosting.
But this will only extend the problem. This is not a salvation.
But for the 7 months that you've been here, obviously you've become very aware that we had a housing shortage and that housing was very expensive here anyway. Do you think that there's anything that really could have been done differently by the government, knowing that there was already a shortage of accommodation, wanting to try and do the best thing possible for people like you fleeing a war, but not having a ready-made stock of accommodation to put you in?
They can only extend our living here. And I think the issue could be they can provide some barracks or housing, like for a short-term period of
staying. Would that still be preferable
maybe
to a lot of other
Germany,
options?
Germany does the same. And actually, I know about the situation is in Germany. They provided the type of housing several years ago. But there are so many people staying there for years and years. And then local government would say, you're no longer able to stay here. We're no longer interested.
What has happened in those cases? They just expect people to go home?
They have to travel home.
They go home.
Yeah, yeah. They have something like the card or something, like a permanent stay residence. And instead of that, they can even leave, they can even work. And somehow government shall say you, you're no longer needed here.
I mean, we've seen, you know, temporary accommodation right across Europe, even particularly at border crossings. I was at Medica at the time in Poland when the war first broke out. And, you know, some of those setups people will understand are fine for, like, as you said, a night or two, kind of a temporary basis. But do you think it's time, and you kind of alluded to it there already, that, you know, Ireland be more transparent with people who are coming now about what actually is on offer? And do you see that transparency taking place? I suppose maybe you don't keep an eye on the forums as much as you did when you were travelling, but do you see that transparency happening now?
No. No one covers this issue over the media. No one. Okay. Only. But you see, local Ukrainians don't monitor like Irish media.
Yeah.
They don't.
Why would they? Of course.
Yeah.
Why
don't search for housing problems and all of that. Mm. They were told there would be good conditions of living provided, and they're waiting to settle down, I think, at least for several years.
Mm.
But it's impossible.
What's the atmosphere like amongst Ukrainians who are here now then? I mean, if they have that sort of view and they see the situation with regards to accommodation, they see that the atmosphere, as you say, has sort of changed to some degree. What are Ukrainians at the moment talking about in Ireland?
They don't know what to do.
Yeah. Mm.
Because the country itself is amazing. People are amazing. I think the most reason of their staying is are people. People.
Mm.
So the people are great and the country isn't.
Yeah, it's a treasure. Yeah.
Well, thanks for your nice words about the people at least. But it must be very difficult to try and get your head around the idea that the people are great, but that the government or that society just isn't as equipped to accommodate you as you might have been told.
Yes, but we are foreigners and there is nothing we can do. We can argue because we are not locals. We don't have any rights to argue with government. That's it. We can't strike. What shall we do? We can only say, it's a pity.
Mm. Alina, one more question for you. I mean, when you look at your country's future, and obviously we're in a situation where nobody knows how long this is going to go on for, but I think everybody around the world has been inspired by what Ukrainian people, how they've pulled together, how they have, you know, endured and showed such resiliency at a horrendous time, the worst possible thing that can happen effectively to a country. What do you think the future is for Ukrainians and for Ukraine as a country?
Well, if we are talking about my humble opinion, I think that Ukraine is no longer the same country and most likely not in the same borders. We don't know if NATO would be engaged into the conflict. If they're engaged, there would be a huge war.
Yeah.
If no, anyways, Ukraine would be split between different countries. Who knows? No one.
Okay.
Or it would be extended conflict for years and years, like 5-10 years. Anything can happen. Ukraine somehow is a great country, but absolutely unpredictable.
Yeah. It's a horrible situation to be in. But Alina, thank you so much for coming in and trying to put into words a lot of what we talk about in the abstract, you know, and about when we talk about accommodation, when we talk about Ukraine and the situation. Thanks so much for coming in and telling us firsthand.
Alina, can I just say, I think our country is all the more richer for having people like you. So thank you for choosing Ireland and thank you for being here.
Thank you too. Thank you to guys because of welcoming. It's really appreciative.
Alina Kalmakova there joining us on the group chat a little bit earlier on. Really fascinating insight, I think, into the situation facing Ukrainians who have come here, as well as a little bit about her own views, I suppose, for her country and whether or not she'll return there. It is interesting. We were just talking about it there as we finished off. It's so interesting that one of her first experiences of Irish, you know, of arriving in Ireland is, first of all, being here on St. Patrick's Day as her arrival date.
Yeah.
And then being handed Penny's pajamas is pretty
that.
Irish, isn't
like,
it?
Yeah. Thanks, Owen Penny's. Total Irish culture.
Really more Irish than the Irish themselves straight away. I was really struck by, I mean, maybe you got a better sense of it, Zara, when you were there in March, but that I wasn't aware that the Irish government had made a point of trying to communicate to the people in Ukraine that the country was effectively open for business, that we had waived visas, that we were going to allow full refugee status for at least a year, and that we were arms wide open.
Yeah.
And knowing that they did, it's very striking then that she says that, you know, there hasn't been a similar follow-up now to sort of make people fully aware that if they were coming, that they're not going to be coming to great living circumstances because we've effectively run out of beds.
Yeah, the time I was there now, there wasn't that. Well, I didn't see that communications because I don't think the decision had been fully made around that time when I was there. But I think she seems to be pointing to, and I feel like we've talked a lot about communications issues on this podcast and this government, but she is kind of more or less saying, isn't she, that this is the issue that, like, she was basically saying that, like, in the beginning, there was this kind of reasonable expectation of what people could anticipate coming to Ireland, that she was saying they were promised kind of hotel accommodation. She's saying that didn't really deliver in a lot of cases. cases, that, you know, there was some level of reasonable expectation when you came to Ireland. Now she's saying that there's not the same level of transparency in terms of what people can expect.
I think that's interesting because this is something that the Ukrainian ambassador said over the weekend, is that she said it was unacceptable. And I think her comments have actually been quite distorted, that it was basically now been treated as the Ukrainian ambassador said it was unacceptable that there was no accommodation, rather than what she actually said, which is that it was unacceptable that people weren't told that there'd be no accommodation and they might choose other countries. And I think a lot of people have been politically spinning that for their own gain. But interesting that that communications thing is something that Alina picked up on as well. I actually must say, I got a DM from a Fine Gael member of the Oireachtas there just actually yesterday, I think, saying that the Ukrainian ambassador must withdraw her comment about the accommodation shortage.
I think I got the same one.
Probably did.
We'll debrief afterwards.
Probably the same thing, that she must withdraw this comment, and that Ireland has been forthright about the situation at all times, which is interesting when if the people who are on the receiving end of the message aren't just getting that
correctly, then there is a communication issue.
And I just think that there's almost a softness towards any criticism. For one, it's a difficult situation to manage. It's a difficult situation to manage, but you have to be open to criticism and a bit of feedback along the way.
But like, I feel like we have been saying this to government ministers, all of us at doorsteps, for the last like 4 months at least, if not more than that. You know, I remember having a doorstep with a minister back in sort of April, May time saying, like, it's all well and good for us to be, you know, we're opening the doors and we're you know, letting people in. But if we can't offer people a reasonable standard of accommodation, then are we part of the problem as opposed to being part of the solution? And you were just kept, like, I suppose the mantra has always been that people are safer here than they are in Ukraine. And obviously you can't, you know, it's difficult to argue that. But it's just that, you know, Alina is talking about that today, in the sense that you can't invite people here and then have them effectively coming here to be homeless. Like, that's not an acceptable standard of living. And like, government ministers have known about this for a really long time. And it's just that when it was that short notice, like, oh, we're running out of space, it was like, really? I think we kind of knew that this was going to happen about 4 months ago. So why are you only...
It had happened.
Had happened. Like, why are you only flagging it now?
And I think there was a bit of clarity there from Alina as well, that it's not as if those who are coming here are ungrateful, and that if they were told, or if they were given some reasonable explanation
as to what
they were going to arrive into, that they'll still likely come because... As she didn't say herself, but I think the implication was fairly clear, they would rather be on a gym floor in Dublin than be at home with the risks that they face being at home. So that, like, just take that as a given, but that if they only knew what they were coming to, then it wouldn't feel like it was an immediate letdown. Because I'm sure it would sow seeds of doubt in people's minds as well, that if you're coming and you think you're going to have at least some sort of hotel or sheltered accommodation, and then you end up in a gym, then it sort of makes you wonder whether anything else that you might have promised, if you're told that you're going to have access to the labour market, or if you're told you're going to have access to certain welfare payments, that it would sow seeds of doubt in their mind too as to what exactly they're coming here. And then when they're coming, and they're coming with their arms wide open, they're coming to a veil of generosity, it's a real shame to feel like you're letting them down on the very first day they arrive.
Completely. And you know, when you talk about Larisa Gorasco, the Ukrainian ambassador as well, I think like this idea of misinterpreting her comments is interesting, because like the whole way through, she has been nothing but careful with her wording, and has actually been nothing but dignified in what has been a really difficult time for her people. And I think to give that woman credit where it's due, she has absolutely held herself with great dignity and respect, and has always expressed gratitude to Ireland for what they've done for her people. And so, you know, I think it's quite unreasonable actually to have taken what she said in that context and twisted. I think like that's, you know, it's very much taking away her character in some ways, in terms of insinuating that she had been in some way ungrateful. That is absolutely not the case, and that she's not been known for being like that at all. She's been nothing but dignified and grateful through this whole thing.
And it is something to watch now as things progress. I was up in Cavan at the British Irish Parliamentary Gathering, Conference, whatever you want to call it. So it's Assembly, isn't it? The Taoiseach was speaking at that, and it was after the weekend of all of the difficulty that there has been with regards to accommodation for refugees, both from Ukraine and those through the international protection system as well. And he did express concern about political exploitation of these things, that there would be spins, that there would be people who are looking to exploit some concerns which local people might have about things like modular housing, and really trying to get their own gain out of it. And I think that is something to watch as we push on through the winter on this. But with regards to actually what is going to be put in place to try and address this issue, I was covering the cabinet subcommittee meeting earlier on in the week, about what could possibly be done. There was stuff like talking about Defence Forces barracks, a lot of accommodation there, which hasn't been used yet. Also, the fact that some of those sites would actually now suit then to put some modular housing on, because I think some of the concern that we've seen in some places, like in Mayo, is that some local people and some local councillors don't want to see modular housing going up in the centre of a town and then it be there forever that they're looking at.
Because it just changes the character of the town centre, which is kind of a reasonable point. And then also sometimes gets taken up in other ways as well, where it's presented as if it's some sort of malicious anti-Ukrainian housing or anti any kind of housing, when maybe it's meant in a different way. So the fruits of that subcommittee, I think, are going to be signed off by Cabinet as a whole on Friday. They're not going to meet again. It's one of those incorporeal meetings where they all get individually phoned up and they're asked, are you okay with us doing certain things? Okay. They're going to sign off on probably some planning changes to allow for modular housing. They're going to sign off on increasing the allowance that Alina mentioned, the €400 allowance that people currently get for offering out lodging. That's going to be increased to €800. By their own admission, a lot of government sources don't think it's going to make that much of a difference, but if it helps, it helps, and so be it. And they're also then going to be talking about taking on some of those Defence Forces barracks. And somewhat ironically, and maybe this is where the lines get blurred between the short-term refugee accommodation crisis and the longer-term accommodation crisis, a lot of Defence Forces barracks had been privately earmarked once upon a time to be, you know, completely remodeled or to be repurposed and to be ultimately used for long-term public social housing.
Okay.
And now that's going to happen, but probably not for the circumstances as was originally intended. And that's maybe where a lot of the distrust or some of the political unease creeps in, that something that was intended for long-term housing for those who are already here is going to be long-term housing, but for new arrivals to the shores.
And I was just, what are the, I don't actually know the numbers, maybe we don't, just what are the numbers arriving every week now? Have they slowed down?
It has slightly slowed down last I'd heard. So basically it was up to a peak of around 1,300 to 1,400 as far as I'm aware early on in October, when you saw a lot more of those missile attacks happening in Kyiv and other city centres. That sparked a renewed pushed for the exit doors, really.
People who had stayed said, we have to get out of here.
People who had stayed, actually, in some cases, some people who'd actually returned to Ukraine actually left again. Actually, Alina sort of mentioned that as well when she was talking to her friends. That has dropped off somewhat, a little bit back to down towards the 1,000 mark per week, as far as I'm aware from people I've been talking about. So that's dropped down a little bit, but they can't really be certain as to, you know, where the numbers are going.
Where it will stabilize there.
Remember, Zara, when we were talking about this at the start, and the government sources were quoting figures of
200,000.
200,000. Yeah. So there is a real lack of certainty, and that will ebb and flow depending on the circumstances of the war itself as well.
Yeah.
One thing as well, just to finish off on Alina before we go, and we're incredibly grateful for her for coming in.
Absolutely.
Her views on sort of the political situation both here and in Ukraine, I think it's worth mentioning, because it is very easy to get into the circumstances where you think, here's what one person says, and she's from Ukraine, so this is what Ukrainians think. Yeah. Whereas we are all Irish people, and if you see the political disagreements that we have in our country, those also apply in Ukraine. So her views on whatever the state of Ukraine will be going forward, very much not shared by a lot of Ukrainian people, I would know. So it is interesting. It's great to hear different perspectives. So if we do have anybody from Ukraine who's living here or elsewhere, do let us know your own thoughts on
that. There was only a big global forum in the last couple of days in Berlin where they were talking about the Ukrainian government looking for a lot of international aid to help rebuild, to try and return it to as close as its previous state as possible. So who knows whether it ever happened, but it is at least the stated goal of the Ukrainian government and for a lot of their international allies to try and put it back to as close to, if not better than, the infrastructural state that it was in before all this happened.
Definitely. I think the majority of people that come here, Richard, don't they say they want to go home eventually? Like, they have an optimism or an ambition to return.
They do, yeah. And I think, absolutely. I mean, you would as well in your situation.
Totally.
Like, it depends on, there's so many different factors. Some places, some towns have effectively been wiped off the map.
Yeah.
That is something you need to bear in mind with regards to some Ukrainians. So it's very difficult when you haven't got that family attachment or that home to return to.
Yeah.
But for some others, if you're, you know, fled from Kyiv or you've fled from Kharkiv, that you might want to go back to that city, which was, you know, it's very much part of your character and the essence of your being. But we'll come back to Ukraine, I'm sure, in future episodes. But we want to round off on many, many weeks of UK coverage.
I feel like we've talked about this.
We're going to keep this brief because I'm tired of them.
This is season two of the group chat, and we're on our third British Prime Minister.
We're outlasting them. They're dropping like flies. Yeah. I wonder if we'll get another one by the end of the season.
Do you know what? I kind of secretly love it. I do love it. I think it's been brilliant. Like, it's been quite I mean, just I've had so many great nights flicking between the news channels, I have to say. I've just loved it. Like,
it has been great.
It has been great.
I thought that I was the biggest political nerd here, and that's
no, I'm sorry, I love
that's
it.
Like among the saddest.
I love when we're live texting each other the BBC News at 10. I'm like, we're nerds, but
those,
I love
those
this.
Nights are wild.
They're great. Yeah.
So to recap, we do have another British Prime Minister by the name of Rishi Sunak. He is the youngest British Prime Minister in the last 200 years, at the age of 42. He's also the first British Asian Prime Minister, which is a fantastic, I suppose, cultural landmark in that country. But he does face a lot of challenges. It is remarkable that he has ended up there. As I was watching Prime Minister's questions there today, that he lost the leadership election to Liz Truss, and he's ended up there effectively by default. Mm. The person who beat him very handily to the Conservative leadership was also beaten by a lettuce.
Yes.
So it is remarkable to see him finally end up there.
Yeah. Do you remember when Liz Truss, remember you went, oh, never have I known a British Prime Minister to have a busier entry. And I was like, but Gav, we always say that about Prime Ministers. But I really feel like Rishi Sunak.
Like cliche, but it's great.
I feel like Rishi Sunak is really now this like
escalating
this
escalating exponential
yeah.
curve of yeah. stuff in the entry. Because yeah. if he had taken the job 7 weeks ago, because it's only 7 weeks since he was beaten by Liz Truss. If he had taken the job 7 weeks ago, the job would be objectively an awful lot easier than it now is.
But I was just going to say, and like, would Britain be a totally different place had he originally?
Not necessarily a totally different place,
but there would have been a lot of things.
So much of what he and his government now have to do is to try and reinforce this idea that they are a credible global player, not only politically, diplomatically, but also financially, because that's a reputation that's been pretty much dragged to shreds by the last 50 days. So the cost of borrowing for the British government, which is the real benchmark, has come back down now to about where it was 7 weeks ago. But anything that might sound like it's injecting a little bit of doubt or a little bit of hesitancy into the whole thing will see the cost of borrowing for the British government increase quite a bit again. And that will have knock-on effects for everyone else in the country. If you've got a variable rate mortgage, suddenly your mortgage will become dearer. And of course, there's still the huge cost of living crisis in the country, and inflation is there, is running at 10%. So there's an enormous amount to do. And because of the events of the last 7 weeks, anything that he might like to do is likely to be that little bit more challenging to pull off. As well as, of course, the fact that the public didn't put him in there in the first place. And how many times can you credibly get away with changing leader before eventually deciding that the public need to have their say?
One of the best quotes I saw was somebody who was a comedian who said, I've had more of a say on the winner of Love Island than I have in the Prime Minister of my own country.
The true democracy of Great Britain is that phone-in vote. Having covered this for the last couple of days, it is interesting to see how he has assumed the role. Mm. His first thing was his acceptance speech, which was about... how long was his acceptance speech in the end? It wasn't very long. It was about a minute and 34 seconds.
His Conservatives was a minute and 23 seconds, which was shorter than the minute and 29 that Truss had done when she resigned.
It was incredibly robotic. It was straight down. It struck to me as a very nervous speech. People again were pointing out, as I'd forgotten, he did sound somewhat like Will from The Inbetweeners in terms of vocal doppelganger.
Government friend.
But he then, obviously, once he got into number 10, did a much better speech, I would say. Mm. But it was so interesting what he did say in those speeches, in that he very much did lay the blame on Liz Truss's doorstep, saying that mistakes were made, I've been elected to fix them. He also, and I think this is actually what's probably been missed, is actually he did fire a shot back across the bow of Boris Johnson. Now, it's fairly understood now that Boris Johnson's camp and Rishi Sunak's camp absolutely loathe each other in some sort of death row, like they are very much identically.
It's like Sherlock Holmes and Moriarty falling off the Reichenbach Falls. They're going to go down together. It's the only way.
Boris Johnson did not, his sweeping back into power did not deliver him back into power. No. Rishi Sunak, in his speech, just to sort of hammer home the reference, he says that the 2019 election, which Boris Johnson Ron Toman.
I won that. That was my mandate.
Rishi Sunak saying that doesn't belong to any one individual. Mm. Wink, wink, Boris Johnson. Because Boris Johnson, after failing Zara in his I'm coming back early from holidays, am I a serious man? very much pointed to the fact that I'm the only one who can win an election. Were you surprised to see him throw in the towel this time?
I mean, look, Boris Johnson will still fancy himself for a comeback at some stage in his life, but I mean, he needs to take a leaf out of the likes of Kylie Minogue's book. She's the comeback queen, and I think she could definitely give Boris Johnson a couple of tips.
If that includes sartorial, that's an image I'm going to need an ad break to get my head around. That's Boris Johnson and hot pants. No, I need a moment.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
All right, welcome back to the group chat. Other big news this week in Ireland was something that was long mooted. Pubs to be allowed to remain open until 12:30 a.m., 7 days a week. Nightclubs allowed to stay open until 6 a.m. under this new overhaul of licensing laws, which was approved by the government. Gav, you were covering this. Run through some of the key actual changes here and what a difference they'll make to how nightlife runs in this country.
So pubs are currently 7 days a week only allowed to remain open until 11:30. I think last order is possibly at 11 and then kick you out at 11:30 and that's it, the doors are shut. Now it's going to be 12:30 and they're going to be allowed to open at the same time every day of the week. So whereas they're only allowed to open at 12:30 on Sundays now, they'd be allowed to open if they want to from 10:30 every day of the week and close at midnight. Currently as it stands, and this has been a real bone of contention, and we would have covered this a bit during lockdown where they were talking about how difficult it was to get going, nightclubs and late bars have to apply for a new license, a special exemption order it's called, every night that they want to stay open beyond the usual closing time. And it's hugely expensive, and then it means that they end up having to charge a bit more for late drinks because they need to cover their overheads. That's now going to be gotten rid of. There's only going to be a single license you can apply for on an annual basis. You get it once for a nominal fee and that's it.
So it's like rolling permission
for a full year at a time, just as you get with a pub license every year. You'll be allowed to stay open until 2:30. And nightclubs, as you mentioned, Richard, will be allowed to stay serving until 5:00 if there is a dance floor that covers 20% of the floor space of the premises and if there is a live band or a DJ.
That's the definition of a nightclub.
That's
literally
the definition of a nightclub. The government has legislated for the definition of nightclubs. If there's live music or live DJ, they're allowed to serve until 5 and have dancing until 6:00 in the morning. Now it's worth
legs would be tired at that hour in the morning.
I just wouldn't have the energy to be staying out that late at all.
I've seen you hold on at that hour of the night. Now
I can't anymore.
No, you can't anymore. We're definitely in your day.
Definitely in my day.
In your day,
I'd have carried through.
We had a few late night dances in our day.
It's an enormous body of work to do because there's such a hodgepodge and patchwork quilt of laws that already exist that actually it's a very laborious thing to go through them all and figure out which parts you're going to take, which parts you're not, and then to wipe the whole slate clean. And it's taken ages to even get it this far, and it's probably going to be sometime before the middle of next year before they actually get all of this in place. The problem, of course, being that as we'll have heard and as a lot of our viewers and listeners will have been telling us in the last couple of days, that it's 5 or 10 years too late, because you're talking about nightclubs being allowed to stay open until 6:00 in the morning. Well, where is your nearest nightclub? Because once upon a time,
it closed down.
Yeah, I think Give Us the Night campaign, I think, had figures that in the middle of the 2000s, there were 460 odd, they might be able to clarify for this, I think it was 460 odd nightclubs, I think, in the Republic in the middle of the noughties. And at last count, which was possibly even pre-pandemic, there were 85.
What?
If you think of a lot of like regional
85?
Regional towns, the number of actual only just one club now.
Designated nightclubs has fallen through the floor, yeah.
I did not
realize that was a trend before the pandemic, and actually that obviously hastened things as well.
That's enormous. Yeah. I didn't realize it was that.
There's one other part as well, which I didn't realize was part of licensing law, and which is significant, but it's going to take a couple of years to do, which is that right now, if you want to open a new pub or a new off license, you can't go to a court and say, can I have a license, please? You have to buy the license off someone who's already got one. Which means that if you have a supermarket that wants to open up a new off license, they'll end up buying the license from some other pub or some other off license. That pub closes and then it doesn't really come back. And a lot of rural places that have had an off license that might have shut, or a local pub that might have shut, if that license is surrendered, nobody goes to court and gets it renewed. That license is kind of gone and gone forever. So, and now they are going to allow people to go back to court and apply for a new license. It's going to be a couple of years before they do that, but at least they're going to give people the option to open up pubs where no pub previously existed before, which could be great for more rural parts.
That's what I was going to ask you. So the nightclubs that closed down and their licences lapsed, did they ever get to come back?
If they lapsed, they are gone under the current law, and they will stay gone at least for 3 years. But a lot of the time what happens is that they get bought by the local supermarket because they want to open an off licence, but they need the licence to actually do that. So they buy the licence that was held by your local nightclub, and that's where the license goes, which then you're wondering, oh God, I wonder would the hotel ever open up that nightclub again?
I remember.
They just don't have the license to do it.
Growing up in Waterford, like when I first started going out when I was 18, and like there was four nights. There was a corner in Waterford City, and it was like there was Ruby's. We used to go to Ruby's back in the day, and there was Mason's across the road. It was kind of like a late bar nightclub, and then there was Muldoon's, and then there was Revolution. Like there was like four nightclubs within, like on one corner. Like it was. Like Waterford was kind of hopping in its day.
Wow.
Yeah. But did you not? You would have probably had, well,
I don't know.
Maybe not. Rush doesn't have a nightclub, does it?
Scaries did.
Scaries did, okay.
I'm not sure what's there now.
Past tense.
I'm not sure. I actually genuinely don't know. But like, it was Scaries and Balbriggan for us, really. So it was Shags in Scaries and Home in Balbriggan.
Home
in Balbriggan.
Shags and Home.
And then for a while, it was the right venue then in...
Used
to be a bus down to the right venue in Swords as well.
Us country kids used to watch the kids in Dublin going to the right venue thinking it was
with 50 Cent and whatnot were turning up.
Like 50 Cent played Waterford, you know, one time.
Yeah, I actually remember that.
The late great Coolio played Waterford one time, didn't
he?
Yeah, I think that the local...
I was there the day 50 Cent
Darren Skelton from the Waterford News and Star was posting this.
Darren Skelton now, give him a shout out. He used to organise a lot of great club nights in Waterford back in the day.
Including the night from Coolio.
Yeah, it was
big. So the like nightlife in the country has really withered in the last... It's multiple things. It's the price of drink and it's people pre-drinking, which means that there isn't as much of an appetite for them to go to somewhere for the whole length of a night, and nightclubs find it harder to pay the overheads if people are going to be in for the last couple of hours. But like, it is striking how few clubs there are now if you just objectively audit them compared to 10 years ago.
Where do people go when you're in college if there's no nightclubs now?
Raves. It's an informal thing now as well because as you were sort of mentioning, Gav, this has been sort of behind the times in that this is something people have been asking for, and they've been asking for things like night czars and stuff like that for quite a long time. People have gone and taken it on themselves to do their own thing. I think there's actually been some reporting around this. I think the Irish Times even did stuff about, you know, Wicklow Mountains raves and all that sort of stuff. And there's a lot of people involved in the techie sector in Dublin. We have these warehouse raves and all that sort of stuff over the last number of years. So that's kind of where people have strayed towards. They've strayed away from the actual licensed part of things and into sort of the grey area of it, really.
But it's probably only economical. Whatever about the legal grey areas, it probably only makes sense if you take the warehouse for once every 3 or 6 months rather than having your rolling license where you expect to open.
You can't do that, yeah. Zara, are you surprised by this? I mean, do you think this is going to be a good thing, or what do you reckon?
I mean, I suppose, like, yeah, I mean, one would hope so. That, I mean, I just didn't probably realise, actually. I'm glad we've had this kind of about the low level of nightclubs. It might be interesting to see if we'll have new nightclubs opening back up again. But I think, kind of based on what we're talking about now, will people go back to nightclubs is the question. You know, if people have become accustomed to like a different way of socialising or a different way of having a night out, as you say, maybe it's a little bit too little too late. But I mean, yeah, look, I mean, it's a long time since I feel like really old now. I feel like before the pandemic, we were good crack, right?
Nah.
I don't know.
We used to go out. So I used to work on the news desk in another place, and we'd finish at midnight on a Thursday evening, and we'd be off on a Friday, and we used to go out like at midnight. We'd be finished work on the news desk. You were out a few of those nights.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Would they have kept going till 6 o'clock if you had the chance?
Definitely four.
Which is technically illegal, isn't it?
We had a great time.
Who knows?
There'll be people, by the way, who'll be thinking, you know, is this not a real public health thing? And we've only just introduced minimum unit pricing, so should we be allowing people more hours to drink? Yeah. Firstly, minimum unit pricing was to stop people buying slabs and drinking them at home. I don't think there's any danger about the alcohol being too affordable when you go out. But B, it's been proven in the UK that where they experimented even with 24-hour licences, some pubs that literally never close. Yeah. You don't have people going in there and binging until their body packs up. They eventually come out in dribs and drabs, and that is part of the goal as well, that instead of having the one night that we went out mid-pandemic liftings and you couldn't get a taxi for love nor money at 11:30 because entire city was emptied out at once, that it does allow the whole thing to roll over and distribute a bit more, so that hopefully when you are coming out of a nightclub at whatever hour, there's a little bit more of a throughput of taxis to get you home.
Sarah, you were working on something else this week. You were working on a report into abortion. This is something which actually, I think, in light of what's happened in other countries, I think there's now a bit of a renewed focus on how abortion is provided here, isn't there?
Yeah, so this is the Irish Women's Council. We're publishing this report this week, and there was just a bit of research into how abortion is working in Ireland at the moment, and just getting some feedback from women who've been through the system. So they spoke to 48 women who had had an abortion under 12 weeks and just kind of wanted to listen to what they had been through. It was interesting to hear that one of the big challenges still remains. safe access zones. So despite the fact that abortion is available in Ireland, that women are still struggling to actually get to a GP that actually helps and provides with that. So only 1 in 8 GPs at the moment are providing the service. And women talked about experiencing, you know, going to maybe a GP who doesn't provide the service and perhaps being maybe tried to be talked out of it, even though she had made her decision before she went there and things like that. So, you know, it was interesting to hear the clarity on that, is that people should go to the My Options website, where they'll be offered 3 GPs within their local area that they know will be able to provide the service. But it was really interesting because I think despite the fact that we've known about abortion being available in Ireland for a long time, admittedly, a lot of us don't understand how that process actually works. So it was interesting to speak at the event yesterday to someone who was able to explain to us in detail exactly how the system works and what the process exactly is.
So for most women, they went to their GP and had the first, you know, took the first medication there. They would have gone home and generally felt fine. The most symptoms they would have had from that was some cramping. And 24 hours later, they took the next medication. And once the second medication is taken, women described usually beginning to bleed, beginning for the, you know, the products of conception to begin to leave their body.
So look, I think it's just interesting to hear how that process works. I think actually a lot of us maybe didn't understand how it works. We're told that 6,500 abortions have taken place in Ireland since it became legal. But as I say, the outstanding issue really is about those safe access zones, and also sort of calls for maybe a daycare facility where women can go if they're going through an abortion, that they have a space to go to be treated. Because in some examples, people didn't have kind of privacy in their own home to go through it. So this was just something else that was possibly suggested for some going forward.
Before we finish up this week, the actions of a climate activist group, Just Stop Oil, has garnered attention around the world. First of all, people might have seen they slopped tomato soup at Vincent van Gogh's Sunflowers, which was behind glass. They threw mashed potato in Germany at a Monet painting. They flung chocolate cake in the faces of King Charles and Camilla at Madame Tussauds in London as well.
Not the real King Charles and Queen Camilla, because that would be objectively quite interesting.
That'd be a hell of a, yeah.
But King
hell of a
Charles
coup for them.
Is like the OG environmentalist, though.
Is he, though?
But like, hasn't he been, like, you know,
he's
before
definitely
everyone else, he was kind of, in fairness.
Yeah. He's definitely spoken out about environmental issues, all right, yeah. And I think, wasn't there a whole, there was a controversy between himself and the former Prime Minister, Liz Truss, about whether or not he would go to COP27
oh,
in Egypt,
right.
There was.
Yeah. Liz Truss was around for 7 weeks and she managed to embroil herself in multiple controversies. That's quite impressive for the short period that she was there. I kind of find the whole thing curious because when it was just the tomato soup one on Vincent van Gogh, I was like, oh, is this an exhibit that's sponsored by some oil company? Because often you might have an exhibition in a gallery which is sponsored by some fossil
fuel shell or something.
That's
that,
why
yeah.
they've gone for it. And that didn't appear to be the case. And I have to admit that I'm, other than it literally just being quite literally a publicity stunt for whatever value there is, I don't know why you would target further priceless works. I mean, I even get the point about, you can say, well,
I feel like the fact that we're having this conversation means they won. Like,
the argument 100%. That they put back was, oh, well, you know, there's only one. This is a priceless masterpiece by Vincent van Gogh. Wouldn't it be terrible if somebody destroyed something which was, you know, priceless and impossible to replace?
Like the planet.
Hint, like the planet.
Yeah.
But a waxwork of the King and Queen is slightly less irreplaceable, so I don't know whether it's
definitely could make it again.
Yeah,
if you had the mold.
I do think it's interesting because I mean, to some degree, it does prove their hypothesis that you will care more about the artwork and, for some reason, the waxwork of King Charles III than the imminent doom of the planet in many ways. I must say I haven't followed exactly what the reasoning was behind the choosing of the targets, but there has been so much backlash at the activists. I think even Rishi Sunak, even Prime Minister's Questions, was having a dig at them as well.
Was he?
Yeah. The Tories don't like the protesters of any real kind.
Keir Starmer was more focused with trying to support the layabout tofu-eating wokerati that were destroying artwork than getting people back to work and getting the trains moving. And not the direct quote,
something
but that was
along
the
those
general
lines.
Gist of it, yeah.
Right.
Okay, I have a rough
You're getting
explanation as to why they did the thing about King Charles. So apparently last year at COP26 in Glasgow, which you were at, Gavin, Queen Elizabeth said the time for words has moved to the time for action. Ellie McFadden, 20-year-old from Glasgow, says the science is clear. The demand is simple. Just stop new oil and gas. It's a piece of cake. So really trying to hold Charles to Elizabeth's words. I get it.
I also get it, but...
I like the creativity like around it.
Who are you trying to convince? Like, Charles is, if not the OG environmentalist, he certainly inherited a love of the natural world from his father, and he's quite a green-fingered bloke, so I just... Don't understand.
I think there's a lot of things you could say, but like in fairness, he has been fairly outspoken about, you know.
But again, the thing is about words versus actions.
Yeah, fair.
And how much international travel and how much, what is the carbon footprint of the British royal family?
Yeah.
Answers on a postcard, folks.
Slightly less now that Charles isn't going to Egypt for COP27,
is
it?
Well, is he? But is that back in the cards now?
It's a new PM.
Liz Truss has abandoned her post.
they'll need him to be a stand-in prime minister by that rate of going.
It is worth, though, I think before we go, it is worth sort of, like, at least whether or not it's a successful action and it has public support. I don't think there's been a lot of talk about the fossil fuel industry and oil and gas exploration on a huge level in terms of the overall discussion around climate change. And maybe it's something we could revisit at some point.
We should definitely do another piece on this. I would love that.
Absolutely. There we go. So there you go.
Therefore,
the protest did work.
Okay.
I say well done on the creativity.
In impacting running order for this show and potentially a future one, that is an unmitigated success.
That is a win.
Huge win.
That is all we have time for, though, on this edition of the group chat.
I loved this one this week.
There you go. That was a good episode.
Alina was great.
Next week or the week after?
Both.
Both weeks.
He's
both
on
weeks.
Next week.
Yeah. So I'll, more details to be revealed, but I'll be phoning in.
Sleep, that is the cliffhanger.
But thanks so much for joining us once again on the group chat. Zara, Gavin.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.
See you next week.
Bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.